Hello and welcome to Happier, a podcast that gives you ideas and tips for how to be happier. This week, we'll talk about why you should stop apologizing and why it's useful to think about whether you prefer variety or familiarity. I'm Gretchen Rubin, a writer who studies happiness, good habits, and human nature. I'm in New York City, and with me in spirit is my sister, Elizabeth Kraft, who is no longer here with me in New York City. And even though I rarely got to see her when she was here, I really like knowing that she was nearby.
Oh, thanks, Gretchen. That's me, Elizabeth Kraft, a TV writer and producer living in LA. And Gretch, now that I'm back home, I can report there's a leaf blower outside my window, which never happens in New York.
Yeah, both cities have their sound, their loud sound problems, but leaf blower is not one of the New York City sounds. Yeah. So how is it to be back home?
It is so great. I mean, you know, I barely got to see Jack during those 5 weeks. So coming home to him was just like euphoria.
Oh,
yeah, really. I mean, just I missed him so much. And Adam. But of course, it's just different. Missing your child is different from missing your husband. But one good thing about being in New York for so long was truly, I think it cured me of my burning desire to move back to New York.
Oh,
like every time I'm in New York, I'm like, I just want to move back here. Why do I live in LA? I should live in New York. And then, but being there for 5 weeks, I was like, yeah, LA is pretty good.
Really?
Yeah.
Because you went to Columbia, so you lived here for a couple years after college. So, and you were a real New York City person.
Yeah, I was there 9 years and I thought I'd be there forever. And then I moved to LA to get into TV writing. But I think it's just, you know, the weather for one, I love the LA weather and just you used to having more space. And after a while, it just felt a little bit oppressive. All the buildings and concrete, you know,
right. Then not nearly as much plants.
No. Not so green. So anyway, that was a side benefit, I have to say. I feel more settled where I am, even though, yes, I have been here almost 20 years. I just feel like, okay, now I really live here and I don't need to think about going back to New York.
Well, that's a major, that's like in terms of happiness, that's a real benefit to feel like I am where I want to be. It's not like there's some other path that I wish that I were on. I'm where I want to be. That's a huge thing.
Yeah, huge benefit. So now I'm settled in LA. I'm happy, and now we're in post on the pilot. So that's its own other beast.
Another fresh hell. But so you have the try this at home tip for us this week. What was it that you want to suggest?
This week, my try this at home is stop apologizing.
Ooh, now is this something you suffer from yourself, or that you suffer when other people are apologizing, over apologizing?
Well, you know, it comes from I think it's more something I recognize in other people. I may do it. If I do, I'm kind of it's unconscious. But I've noticed that there's a lot of people who feel the need to just, it's like they're apologizing for being alive. You know, it's like they just go through life constantly saying, oh, I'm sorry I did this. I'm sorry I did this. I'm sorry I, you know, interrupted you during dinner. I'm sorry didn't bring the right treats. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And it makes me sad because I feel like, for example, a friend who is just a wonderful person. She'll do anything for you. She's a lot of fun, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But she always is feeling bad about whatever she just said or done.
Yeah.
And I feel like if we moved through life just not apologizing for things that don't need to be apologized for, we'd be happier. What do you think?
I think it's a good point. I think in a way it feels needy to other people, and like now I have to manage your bad feelings, and so it doesn't maybe put them in the right frame of mind. You're trying to apologize, but then they become kind of almost resentful of your apologizing. Like, and I feel that I think I probably under-apologize because I'm kind of a bad mixture of being impatient and absent-minded, and so I think I probably should apologize more. But I do have this aspect of being an upholder. You know, I've talked many times about how I'm an upholder, and upholders never want to do anything wrong.
Mm.
And so I think sometimes as an upholder, I over-apologize as a way to kind of make excuses for myself because I don't want to be seen to be in the wrong. And this just happened today. So we're in this temporary studio, as you know, like in the garment district of all places in New York City. And so I came in and I didn't know where Henry was. So I was looking for Henry and I saw the studio where we'd been before. And then there was this door that didn't look like a studio door. So I opened it. Well, it was a studio door. Uh-oh. And there were like three people in there recording, like full headphones, microphones, everything. So I quickly shut the door and I'm like, oh my gosh, I hope I didn't just like bust into their like key moment, you know, and like create
They're interviewing Hillary Clinton and you're like, hello, Henry?
Exactly. So I didn't apologize right then because clearly it was inappropriate. But then I saw them all out in the hallway and they were deep in conversation. And part of me was like, I should go up there and like really apologize and explain like it wasn't really labeled properly. And there wasn't a window on the door the way there is on the other one. And I'm, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I'm not really at fault. It's really somebody else's fault that I made this mistake. And I'm like, they don't care. It's like, insofar as I inconvenience them, done's done. They're never going to see me again. Like, why would I interrupt their animated conversation just to try to like somehow in some kind of, you know, heavenly register of wrongs done that I, as an upholder, am very aware of, want to clear my name. There's no point to that. It's just for me. It's not for them.
Yeah, I think you're so right. I do think it's a burden to other people. I hadn't even thought of it that way. I'd only thought about it in terms of that person just feeling bad about themselves unnecessarily seems to me like not a good way to go through the day. But you're right. Because just the fact that I'm even thinking this of this as a try this at home, because I experience it, shows that it is kind of a burden to the people you're apologizing to. Because I'll sit there and then feel bad, like, oh, this person is feeling bad that, you know, they asked me what they then decided was too personal of a question. So I need to reassure her it wasn't a personal question and that it was fine to ask me that. And what, you know, and so it creates this dynamic of need on both sides. And I don't know why people do it.
It occurs to me that maybe part of what it is, or maybe a way to stop that cycle of the person apologizing and you reassuring, and then they keep apologizing, and then, it, you know, it kind of goes on for a while and feels tiresome. It feels exhausting for both people, is maybe this idea, which I think works in a lot of situations, which is acknowledge the reality of other people's feelings. And so maybe part of it is when we try to reassure people, we often say like, oh, it doesn't matter, or oh, forget it. But that's not reassuring to them because they don't know that you really understand how they feel. So maybe it's better to kind of rephrase and acknowledge that you understand how they're feeling. Like you could say something like, oh man, I know how it feels like when you forget to bring something to the class party. You feel so terrible. But there is so much food here. The children won't even notice that you didn't bring anything. So it's sort of like, I recognize that you do feel bad and why you feel bad. And like, I know I would feel bad in that same situation. So now we can move on. Because I think sometimes by just telling people to forget it, then they're like, but I can't forget it because I might have hurt your feelings or I might have upset you. And you need to say like, oh, gosh, I know that feeling like when you ask one question too many, you know, I know that feeling, but, you know, it's really no big deal. I don't know if that would help with a person.
I think that's a great idea. I think that would, that could at least, if it doesn't stop the initial apology, it at least stops the cycle there on the spot.
Yeah.
So it's like apologize, then make the person feel better, then it's done.
Well, and I quoted Jamie because he had this magic line in an email to reassure somebody. And I use this now all the time. I rip them off, which is, we've all done it.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that's reassuring to people when you're like, you know, it's a mistake, but we've all done it. It's like, it's not that big a deal. Henry and I were talking about this earlier, and he had some really interesting insights into this apologizing. So, Henry, what are you thinking?
Yeah, I actually have three things that I wanted to bring up.
Oh, he actually made notes on his phone.
Let's hear it. An upholder.
The first thing that I wanted to say is, sometimes when you apologize, you end up then just calling more attention to a mistake that no one else would have even noticed.
Yes.
Like, I do think it's right to own up to mistakes if they're valid, but if no one's noticing that you're like sneezing in the middle of a speech, don't like stand up and say, sorry for sneezing in the middle of your speech. The next thing is, oftentimes a thank you will suffice better than an apology. Like if you go home after a long day at work and you're talking to your friend or your roommate and you're venting, at the end of it, don't say, oh, I'm so sorry, I just vented to you for 20 minutes. Say, thank you for letting me vent to you.
Ah.
People confuse that a lot. And I think it's a great way to avoid that.
And we just had a great example of this because we were in the other studio and we had to move, Elizabeth, because you were in this studio. And so Henry said, he's like, instead of saying, I'm sorry you have to move, I'm going to say, thank you for being flexible. I was like, yes.
Oh, that is genius.
Yeah.
I love
this is
that.
Subtle, but important.
And then the last thing, which kind of undermines what we're saying, but I think we all agree, is that there are often times when a really good apology is warranted.
Yes.
And there's nothing worse than a bad apology when a really good apology is necessary.
That very is so true. Very true.
We need to have a whole thing where we talk about apologies.
Good apologies.
Because I have a lot of thoughts about apologies.
Me too. I'll come back for that one.
Yes, because a good apology that is well warranted can change your life, and a bad apology that is frustrating can make you feel so much more angry than you did before. It's like dangerous.
For the sake of these good apologies, don't cheapen them with your bad apologies.
Yes.
Let's get rid of those.
Yes. No,
Stop apologizing
when needed and, you know, in a heartfelt manner, and let's just forget all this. But it reminds me, Gretch, of the, you know, the Real Housewives franchises.
Yes.
All of them, apologizing is always a top issue. Like,
interesting.
They're always arguing over whether an apology was real or fake, and whether someone is, like, there are certain people who refuse to apologize. So it is a hot button topic in general.
Ooh. Yeah, well, so let us know if you tried this at home, stop apologizing, or kind of your thoughts around this issue, because it feels like it's really rich, and there's a lot going on in terms of why people are apologizing, or why it feels like they're over-apologizing, or why we feel the need to apologize when maybe it's not a really an apology situation. Contact us Twitter, Facebook, drop us an email, podcast@GretchenRubin.com, or as always, you can go to my website. This is episode 61, so it's happiercast.com/61. And I feel like this side note, I feel like I don't say enough that there's like, I always try to put a lot of like cool stuff on the blog on the day for the episode. So like, you know, Elizabeth, I had all these pictures that I took last week. For the one about being when we were on the soundstage with you. And we sort of didn't mention on the podcast, like, if you want to see pictures of all this stuff, go to the website. So a lot of times there's links and other kind of additional bonus material on the website. So check that out if you're curious to follow up on stuff that we've talked about.
When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. LinkedIn has a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire. It gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else. LinkedIn does all that while making the process easy and intuitive.
I know that when I've been hiring, it's really hard to do. It's really hard to find quality candidates. It's really hard to handle the process. Hiring is easy when you have lots of quality candidates, like with LinkedIn Jobs. It's so easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/Gretchen. That's linkedin.com/Gretchen to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. So, Elizabeth, here's a question to help you know yourself better, and that is, do you prefer variety or familiarity?
What are some examples?
Okay. So, like, this just came up in my life because every spring break for like the last, I don't know, like 14 years, we've gone on spring break with my in-laws to the very same place. And I said to Jamie, do you like coming back to the same place every year? And he's like, I do like it because it's just like, I know what to expect and I'm going to have my fun. And like, there's no kind of decision-making or anxiety about how it's all going to play out. It's very predictable. And I'm like that too. I like familiarity quite a bit, but for some people that would be nightmarish. Like the idea that you would go back to the same, and there's not a lot going on there either. So it's like, there's not that's happening. But for us, that's okay because we like familiarity. But you kind of, if you know that, then you could look at the situation and be like, you know what, this is going to make me crazy because this is too much familiarity. And I'm a person who likes variety and novelty. Or like, rereading the same book. I love rereading books.
I never reread books.
See, that's interesting. You just, once you've read it, you feel like...
Yeah, I feel like I've read. I mean, rarely. Like, I think The Pistachio Prescription.
Oh, I love that book.
Like, I've read that maybe 10 times. Like, there's a few books that I've read for whatever reason, many times, mostly young adult books.
Yeah.
Like, just the other day, I was thinking, maybe I should reread Gone with the Wind.
Oh, my gosh, it's so good.
Eh, I've read it. Why not go? That's too, it's going to take too long, you know?
What about watching a TV show? Would you watch a TV show? Like, I know you loved the last episode of Mad Men. Would you watch that again?
No, I rarely. I did actually rewatch the pilot of Mad Men the other day because I didn't remember it at all. But I haven't rewatched the finale, although I rewatched the last like minute of the finale about 10 times because it was my favorite minute of television ever. But I, in general, like, I won't go back and go, oh, let me rewatch, you know, Game of Thrones from the beginning or something.
Right. Right.
I feel like I should move on to something new. Well, like, it seems like a waste of time. But why does this even matter?
Well, I think it's a good question to know about yourself, because if you know, if you're more inclined to familiarity or variety, you can set things up in a way. And I was thinking about this because I was talking to a journalist about habits, because, you know, she was interviewing me about Better Than Before. And as sometimes happens, and it's always my favorite thing when it happens, she said, like, well, now can we talk about me and my habits, and you can just, like, be my therapist? And I was like, yes, because that's my favorite thing to do. So she was saying how she wanted to work on the habit of having a healthy lunch. She often got fast food for lunch, and she wanted to have a healthy lunch. And so she was going to bring lunch from home or have a healthy lunch. And she was saying, and one of the things I talk about in Better Than Before, which is how every decision that we make can drain us, and habits can be good because they eliminate decision making. And so... and she was saying, well, because I should eliminate decision making, I should probably have the same lunch every single day, right? I should pick one healthy lunch and eat the same thing every day. And I said to her, well, no, I don't know about that, because, like, I'm a person who basically does eat the same food every day, and I like that. But for many people, they don't like that, and they do much better. They need a lot of variety in their diet, or they, you know, they start to not like it. And she goes, oh, well, I'm definitely somebody who needs a lot of variety in what I eat. And I was like, well, then don't set it up. And then you're kind of burdening the healthy choice with this kind of unnecessary aspect of being the same thing every day. So I was like, well, let's think. And she goes, but then I have to make decisions. I was like, well, we can limit the decisions to something that's manageable. Like, let's pick two things that you could order that are healthy. You know, you could have this or you could have that from like the takeout place. That would be healthy choices. And she said, or I could bring in leftovers, because a lot of times I'll have like something healthy for dinner the night before and I can bring in a leftover. And I was like, okay, well, that's great, because that's no choice. That's just like, I'm going to eat for lunch whatever I ate last night, but it's going to be changing because what you eat for dinner is changing. So there's no decision, and yet there's variety. And then she seemed so much more optimistic about her ability to stick to this new way of eating lunch, because she felt like, I have to be in this prison of eating, you know, Cobb salad every single day for the rest of my life, or I'm going to be eating, you know, fast food, junk food. And I'm like, well, no, you can plug in variety, you know, but you need to recognize that it's of value.
And it kind of goes, so I can see, like, if you're someone who likes familiarity, then don't think you want to go to a different exercise class every day.
Right.
Just get into your groove and do that, and don't feel bad that you're not, you know, trying, something new.
Right. Whereas for somebody else, that could be a real value. Like, oh, I'm going to join this big gym that has tons of options so that I can have a lot of variety, even though I'm exercising. Now, I will say this, from a research perspective, research definitely shows that people who do novel and challenging things are happier than people that do the same thing all the time. And this was a challenge for me when I was writing The Happiness Project, because I thought, well, that's what the research shows. But I'm a person who loves familiarity and mastery, so I'm going to find out that's not true for me. And that's why I started my blog, to do something novel and challenging. And I found that it was a huge source of happiness. Or like when we do every 10th episode, when we do a very special episode and we're shaking things up, and it's, you know, it's a little bit unnerving because we're doing something new and challenging, but then it ends up being really fun. Yeah. So there is that aspect of novelty and challenge. But I do feel like in kind of everyday life, some people do take a great joy in familiarity that others don't feel.
And I also think it matters what's going on in your life. Like, I even noticed this morning, totally unconnected from this conversation, that because I'm in this intense work period, I am reverting back to wearing jeans, sneakers, and hoodie in a white t-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like every day. And that's what I, that's my comfort.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
When I'm in a period that's less intensive, I might mix it up, but I want, if like things are chaotic around me, I want to like have my things that are familiar and safe and comfortable.
Well, so here's something really interesting about the research. So some people assume that when you're under a lot of stress, you're automatically going to fall into bad habits. But what the research shows is that when you are under a lot of stress, you fall into habits, you embrace habits more intensely, whether they are good or bad. So they looked at students who are during exams, and what they found is like the students who usually like ate breakfast more consistently, and that students who usually didn't eat breakfast, didn't eat breakfast. And it's sort of like, so if you're in the habit of eating healthfully, if you're under a lot of stress, you're going to go deeper into eating healthfully because that it's like that's your hoodie and running shoes. Mm-hmm. That's the comfortable habit that's reassuring to you because it's so familiar. If you're in the habit of wearing, you know, stilettos, you know, and like super tight clothes, then you'll do that because that's your habit. So it's sort of like you go. So that's another reason to want to have good habits is because when you get into that need of wanting the comfort of habits, the familiarity of habits, you want to fall into a place that's constructive. It's funny. I'm such a familiarity lover that I'm surprised often by how some people just really, they always want variety as much as they can. It's just important to recognize what you prefer.
Gretchen, I bet this is an issue that affects couples. Like you have one person who likes familiarity and one person who likes variety, that could lead to major conflict.
Yeah.
So you and Jamie are both familiarity people. I think Adam and I probably tend toward familiarity, at least on big issues.
I've had a lot of people are mixed too. It might be you're one with vacations and another with food, or one with books and another with travel. I don't know. But it's interesting to think about, though. I mean, just in terms of knowing yourself better, it's sort of an interesting thing to think about.
Okay, Gretch, it is time for a listener question. And before we dive in, I want to remind everyone that you can email us, but you can also leave us a voicemail question. And we love getting voicemails because there's just something about hearing our listeners' voices, which is incredibly satisfying.
Yeah.
So please do leave us a voicemail question. The number is 774-277-9336, or easier to remember, 77-HAPPY-336. Hopefully this week we'll get lots of voicemail questions. But this week, Gretchen, we have an email question, which is from Emily. And we actually don't have an answer for this question, but we think it's a good question. So here it is. I have a happiness problem of my own, online passwords. I find it impossible to remember them, particularly when every online entity requires their own special combination of letters, characters, etc. Some passwords are more important than others, bank and Amazon passwords versus password for online shopping site I needed one time. It seems everything online now requires a password. The problem is I can never remember the passwords. I run through a cycle of setting up a password, not needing it for months, forgetting it, resetting it, repeat. You get the idea. Should I write down every password? This is a recipe for disaster. I'm prone to forget where I've written passwords down. I'm writing you as I've had to reset my PayPal account for the nth time. I'm locked out of my account now and have currently been on hold for 40 minutes trying to access my account again. Help. So this, I mean, this is a question, the question of our time.
Yeah. Well, and it's definitely a question for me because I keep thinking there's got to be like some clever system that I, help. What to do? I have nothing here and I desperately need the answer. Yes.
Nothing. Because you don't want to put it in your phone.
No.
Because if your phone is taken, it could be, you know, people could find your passwords. And the problem is when you, you know, say you have five passwords you use and you could say, well, I'll cycle through all of them. But a lot of places lock you out if you try too many times.
Yes.
So it's, I think it's something that we all are just plagued by constantly.
Well, and I think, I bet there's some listener who's come up with some perfect solution that's like very clever and obvious once you hear it. So please.
Yeah, I think we need some listener answers on this one.
Yes. And remember who you're dealing with here. It's got to be the lowest possible bar. So there's no like set up an algorithm that,
yes, you know, exactly.
based on the number of letters in the end, you know. But I'm sure that's great. So people will solve this problem for us. Let's hope. But Elizabeth, also, we got all these great responses to our Lucky Charms. You know, in episode 59, we talked about why you might want to give yourself a Lucky Charm and why that's actually can be actually helpful, even though it's a superstition. And I just wanted to read you some of these great Lucky Charms that people told us about.
Oh, good.
Well, the first game, Kylie on Twitter pointed out something, which is the most obvious illusion that I can't believe we didn't mention this in our discussion because we are both such Harry Potter fans. But of course, a great example of how a lucky charm can work, even if it's not really anything that's changing anything, it's like the placebo effect, as you pointed out, is in Harry Potter when Harry gives Ron, he pretends to give Ron the Felix Felicis potion, and then Ron's performance improves because he thinks he's taken the lucky charm. But of course, Harry didn't even give it to him. So that's a good example. I was like, oh my gosh, that's the most obvious example of this principle. So Kylie, thank you for reminding me. I always want to have an opportunity to talk about Harry Potter. So Emma in the UK has a great one. Whenever she has a job interview, she wears her most amazing underwear. She says, obviously, it's totally unseen by the interviewers, but it makes me feel awesome when I'm getting dressed. It's a great confidence boost. So I thought that was a great one.
If I had any good underwear, I would try that.
Get some. This one comes from Melissa, and she's a law clerk like me, and her judge gave her gave his law clerks a watch as a Christmas gift. And it was a Mickey Mouse watch. And she wears her Mickey Mouse watch as her lucky charm. And the idea is that it's supposed to remind you that it's important to have a good sense of humor. And she's an appellate attorney. And so when she argues in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which is a very big deal, if you don't know your kind of law terms, that's like a very big argument in front of many judges. It's my lucky charm because it helps me stay calm and not get as nervous.
And love that.
Yeah,
that's
Mickey,
great.
Yeah, not take yourself too seriously. And this lucky charm is great. It comes from Rosie from County Down in Northern Ireland. She says, my lucky charms are two doves. When I'm stressed out or worried about something and I find myself looking out a window, by sheer coincidence, my line of sight will appear to alight on a pair of doves sitting on a branch of a tree. This has been happening for years. I've noticed that in times of trouble, they appear, and I take it as a sign that my guardian angels, my grandparents, are watching over me and that everything will be fine. And of course, it always is. I never actively seeking them out, but it does seem to happen whenever there's something going on in life that's worrying me. It always staggers me, gives me great comfort. That's a lovely thought.
That is. I love that.
Here's a great one from Molly. Oh, and Elizabeth, she's from Kansas City.
Love that.
Yeah, hometown. So in 2007, she was diagnosed with a uterine tumor. And as she was going through chemotherapy and feeling really down, she started wearing one of those yellow Live Strong bracelets that a friend gave her. And she decided to wear it as a reminder to stay strong. And she's almost 8 years cancer-free. Amazing. And the bracelet is still my lucky charm. I don't wear it every day, but I do when I need a reminder to keep my strength and push forward. So that's a great lucky charm.
That's great.
And here's this comes from Megan, and she makes a really good point about Lucky Charms. She says, I have a question about helping a child find a Lucky Charm. I worry that my kindergartner, who's incredibly sensitive, will be more anxious with a Lucky Charm. What if he can't find it, or what if he forgets it? What tips do you have for making a Lucky Charm more charming and less an essential security blanket? In some ways, I think it could help him, like on the first day of school. So I'm interested in how to make it work. I think that's a really good point to think about.
Yeah, you don't want to get so attached to your lucky charm that it's like crippling not to have it with you.
And I think for some people that happens.
Well, for a kindergartner, I think you could say it's your lucky charm, but it's always your lucky charm, whether it's on you or not.
Ooh,
you
know? That's a good one.
It's just the sort of overarching power
right.
of the charm.
Wherever it is in the world. Or maybe there's like a lucky gesture that they make, or, you know, like a lucky ritual that's totally within their power. Like you're going to jump 3 times before you walk out the door and that's going to make you lucky or something like that. Because that way you don't have to worry. But again, I think when you have a child or a person who's maybe overly sensitive and might glom onto something too tightly, where it could maybe overmaster them. Maybe you don't want to unleash the power of superstition because you don't want somebody who's 45 years old and feels like he has to jump up and down three times before right. he crosses the, you know, crosses the threshold of his, like, you know, his law firm or something like that. Because though I think a lot of baseball players do have these like weird like things that they go through in a very yeah. public way. But so anyway, I thought Megan was really wise to bring up a point that this should be a fun tool, but you don't want it to become something that could become a problem.
You don't want it to be a crutch.
Yes. Yes. So thank you for bringing that up again. And it was so fun. Keep setting them in. This is just the tip of the iceberg. So
fascinating. This is making me want to have like a million Lucky Charms.
I know. The next time we're together, Elizabeth, we'll do some Lucky Charm related kind of highly structured outing or something like that. I don't know. We'll turn it into like a little adventure.
That sounds good.
This year, I am focused on saving and investing, but I still want to do things like travel. NerdWallet lets you compare top travel credit cards side by side to maximize your spending, some even offering 10 times points on your spending, which means you could end up with a free flight or maybe a better hotel room.
So what could future you do with smarter financial decisions? Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. Okay, demerits, gold stars. Elizabeth, you're up. What's your demerit?
Well, Gretch, this is a demerit I probably could have predicted the moment I knew I was going to be going to New York for
Ooh.
5 weeks.
Ooh.
You know, I have a lot of friends in New York and in the New York area because
yeah.
I lived there for 9 years and a lot of my friends stayed. And these are really close friends who I have actually given myself demerits in the past for not seeing enough of. So my demerit is not seeing my friends enough while I was in New York. Now I saw, you know, it's not that I didn't see any friends. I did see friends. Some friends I saw multiple times. But I have two very close friends. I was in their wedding who I didn't see at all, not one time, Dan and Jess, who
yeah.
are two of my favorite people in the world. One of my best friends, Jahan, I only saw twice. Another friend I only saw once. Another friend I only saw once when I thought I'd be, you know, my plan was to see everyone multiple times. And one big thing I wanted to do was like go to their homes and see their, like, go to my friend Jahan's apartment in Brooklyn. I've never been there. And I've never been to my friend Karen's place in Hastings-on-Hudson. And I was going to sort of just, you know, people like you to see their home.
Yeah.
And I was just, I didn't do it. I was so wiped out that I just didn't take that extra effort to do that. And I totally regret it because I know I would just feel so much more connected if I had done it. So that's that.
I totally understand the feeling I have that sometimes when I'm on book tour and I'm like, oh, I'm in Boston. I have so many friends in Boston. But instead, I stay home in the hotel room and watch HGTV, you know,
right.
because I'm so tired. And so I'm just thinking this through. I'm not even, I don't know if this is true. But now you wanted to go to their house. But I mean, going to Hastings-on-Hudson, going out to Brooklyn when you were stationed kind of in Midtown, do you think you could have lowered the bar and said to them, I am such a wimp, I cannot leave the hotel, but if you can come to the hotel bar and meet me, I would love to see you? And then do you think that would have worked? Or do you think that would have seemed too demanding?
Well, and I did do that,
yeah.
by the way. I did do that. And that's when I saw people largely was in the hotel bar.
Yeah, because you were yeah. working incredibly hard. And I think people would understand that it's like you were working these incredibly long days out of your element. You know, I think people sometimes get it that it's easier for them to come to you. They're in their familiar setting and can kind of organize. And you're like I don't know. Do you think so? That did
well,
work.
You know what the mistake I made though was, is I should have, when I knew I was going and I had the date, I should have said, okay, Jahan, I'm going to come to your apartment Wednesday night, because the first couple of weeks I was there, we weren't shooting yet. So our days were much shorter and I could have planned a bunch of stuff and done it before we actually started shooting. Cause that's when the days get much, much longer.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just sort of, oh, I'm here, I'm acclimating, yeah. I have so much time to see everyone, it's no rush. And I wish I'd used your strategy of scheduling from the outset.
Yeah.
Because yes, even though I did see people in the hotel bar, I really wanted to, you know,
yeah.
go to their environment as well.
Right.
But, you know, it is what it is. At least I saw a bunch of people. It was wonderful to see them. It was like so rejuvenating to me, the times I did have with these friends. So, you know, that was wonderful. But I just wish I'd made more of an effort and done more of it.
Well, I think you point out there's something that I often encounter too, which is like if you have a span of time, like the summer or spring break, you think there's so much time. Like I often do this with taking pictures, like, oh, we're on spring break, I should take a lot of pictures. But the first couple of days, I'm like, oh, we're going to be here for so long, I don't need to worry about it now. And then it's the last day and I'm like taking 45 pictures of everybody like in the last 2 hours, because you feel like you have so much time that you can, you don't need to use it productively, but then you run out because time passes faster than you think. So now I'm really trying to like pay attention to the beginning, because like you say, it would have been easier for you to do that stuff at the beginning. Yeah, it just feels hard to remember.
So Gretchen, now it's your turn. Let's transition into your gold star.
Okay. Well, this is a gold star I want to give to Dad. And tell me if you noticed this from our childhood, because this is definitely, you know, sometimes like you can pick up a parenting tip because you remember that it worked really well on you as a kid. And this was something that even as a child, I was like, I really appreciate this, about Dad's parenting style. And so I've completely copied it with great success, which is, so sometimes with little kids or even adults, you know, they're kind of complaining about something and they're like, oh, he scratched me. And they're holding out their arm and, you know, you're like, oh, it's a little red, it'll be fine. Or they're like, oh, my stomach hurts. And you're like, oh, well, you know, I'm sure it's nothing, you know, just like in a half an hour, it'll feel better. You sort of dismiss it. And one of the things I always appreciated about Dad was that if you were complaining about something, he took it really seriously. Like he would, like if you said, oh, he scratched me, my arm hurts, he would like look at your arm and say like, I see that it's red, I see the mark right there. Mm-hmm. Or like if you're like, oh, my stomach hurts, he'd be like, well, do you feel like you're sick, or is it like a stabbing pain, or like or like he'd press on your stomach and be like, well, does it hurt more if I press here or here? And I realized that like I just so appreciated that as a child. Like he really gets it. Like I'm in pain here. He's really taking it seriously. And I've noticed that with my daughters, that really helps. And I think as an adult, a lot of time, this is again back to this principle that I just point to all the time, which is acknowledge the reality of other people's feelings. And then as when you say to your kids like, oh, it's nothing, oh, you'll be fine, then they just get more and more enraged and like have to keep insisting that something hurts. And that's very tiresome.
Right.
But when you really recognize it, then a lot of times they can let go of it faster. So I'll say to Eleanor, my daughter, like, well, do you think you need an Advil? Would it help to put a Band-Aid over it? Like, what if what if we put lotion on, you know, just like anything? Then they're like, no, I don't need that. That's okay. I think a lot of times people just want recognition. And even, you know, Jamie recently had back surgery and like, he really wanted me to say things, you know, I could tell he really was gratified. Mm-hmm. When I was like, now let me look at the incision and how does this sore? Mm-hmm. How does this feel? And, you know, do you think you need a Band-Aid? And, you know, like just taking it seriously, that's helpful, because especially when we're in pain, we want other people to recognize it.
Yeah, even on the gold star to Dad front, Gretch, even now, you know, in our updates, we'll often say, well, this is going on and it's stressful, or this horrible thing happened at work. And he always has a helpful comment about it. Like he'll acknowledge it and then he'll also often have some sort of philosophical bon mot about it.
Like what? Like what?
Is that how you say that?
Bon mot, I think.
I can't even think of an example, but he'll be like, oh, it, you know, reminds me of the man who this happened to.
Or the Wichita girls.
You know, he always.
Yeah.
He always has just something reflective to say that's helpful.
Or he will even just say, like, it sounds like there's so much going on, or it sounds stressful. Yeah. It's just like he's acknowledging.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So gold star for Dad, because not only did I appreciate it as a child, it has given me an important tool to use as a parent. And that's it for this episode of Happier. Remember to try this at home. Stop apologizing and let us know what worked for you, and also kind of your observations and insights around this whole issue, because it feels like there's a lot going on there.
Thank you to our producer, Henry Malofsky. Also thanks to Laura Mayer and Andy Bowers of Panoply. Get in touch. Gretchen's on Twitter at Gretchen Rubin, and I'm at Elizabeth Kraft. Our email address is podcast@gretchenrubin.com. And remember to call in with those voicemail questions.
And everyone, for a lot of people in the world, Mother's Day is coming up, at least in the United States. It's coming up on May 8th. And if you want to give one of my books to a mother in your life, I can send you a signed, personalized book plate. Or if the mother that you're giving a gift to has ebooks or audiobooks, I can sign and personalize a signature card for them to make a gift more special. Or you can get one for yourself. you can email me, or if you go to the show notes, this is happiercast.com/61, I'll post a link where you can sign up to request one. Now, unfortunately, I can do this only in the United States and Canada. Because of mailing costs. I'm really sorry about that, but I just can't afford to send them out all over the world. And if you would like this for a Mother's Day gift, please do this pretty soon, because it can take me a while to, because I actually have to do this and mail it back, and I wouldn't want to be late. So that's just an idea if you're thinking about giving a book for Mother's Day.
Until next week, I'm Elizabeth Kraft.
And I'm Gretchen Rubin. Thanks for joining us. Onward and upward.
He betrayed me.
George, I'm sorry.
Oh, you can stuff your sorries in a sack, mister.
I don't know what that means.